The last time the FedEx Cup playoffs visited Colorado, Billy Horschel was on a heater. He won the BMW Championship and, for good measure, took down the Tour Championship the following week. But he's back in Denver and has one eye on Atlanta next week. He's taking time out to join us. Now, John Rahm and Greg Norman are insisting the Spaniard isn't miserable at LIV Golf, but they're kind of missing the point of the article that suggested he is. The author, Jaime Diaz, is here to talk about whether money is compatible with the search for excellence. And Luke Bryan is crashing the party at Castle Pines this week. America's country idol has a concert at the BMW Championship tonight and a pro-am date tomorrow. He's stopping by for some swing tips on the way. Golf Today starts now.
Golf Today.
Welcome into Golf Today. I'm Eamon Lynch alongside George Savarikas. George, you were just in Memphis doing our pre- and post-game shows out there. It's fair to say, you've covered these playoff events a long time, that there's more traction now in terms of at least that cut down to the top 50, because it means a lot more now than it did when you were just guaranteeing yourself another week's work.
Yeah, and we've seen an evolution of the FedEx Cup playoffs since their inception back in 2007. That first year you had 144 guys make it, four events. Now they've slimmed it down to just three events. Top 70 make it to Memphis. Obviously, you jockey for 125 at the end of season to retain your card for the next year. But for it to be maybe a little more than 50% of guys advance to the playoffs, and now everything that's on the line for top 50 with signature events, and how that not only sets you up to make it to the second leg of the playoffs, but you're almost a lock to make the playoffs next year. 86% of guys who were top 50 coming into after last year made the playoffs this year. Yeah. So it was fun watching not only down the stretch, I mean, Hideki Matsuyama blowing a five-shot lead and then somehow coming back to get the win, but the kind of, like, you saw these borderline car crashes of guys finishing their rounds who knew the stress and the heat of trying to finish.
A more palpable sense of tension among those guys.
Yes, and Nick Dunlap had a quote, and, I mean, the guy's won twice now as a rookie on the PGA Tour. And when he won the American Express, he said, "I was so nervous I couldn't feel my hands." When he was going down the stretch and needed to make par on the 18th hole to finish top 50, he said, "I've never been more nervous in my life." And there are different nerves where if you're trying to win a tournament, but if you're trying to win a tournament, you're playing at your best. Yeah. When you're just trying to get top 50, I'd say that's almost like make the cut pressure on steroids. And that's what we saw with these guys, because you had decorated winners. Tom Kim, your heart goes out for him. He finished bogey, double, double, went five over his last three, went four over, would have gotten him top 50 to finish 51st. So I think the PGA Tour, the tweaks that they've made over time, it's getting closer now to where it feels like a playoff that you experience in the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball. They're getting closer there. I don't think they're 100% at what the final form of this will be, but it's definitely, from an atmosphere standpoint and buy-in from the guys, way closer than it was even 5, 10, 15 years ago.
That's an interesting angle, isn't it? You're not at the top of the leaderboard. You're way down the field. The ball's kind of going sideways. You don't have a lot of confidence, but you have still so much at stake right there. And Tom Kim was a perfect example of that.
I can tell you, it is nice to be inside our Golf Channel Worldwide headquarters where it's 72 and sunny sitting next to you.
A little sweaty down there.
just a touch. And, I mean, a guy who was feeling the heat was Hideki Matsuyama down the stretch. He had been a perfect 3-for-3 in his career with a 54-hole lead, but I don't think he could have envisioned having a five-shot lead on the back nine, losing that to trail by one, and then finishing birdie to win the first leg of the FedEx Cup playoffs. What a response from Matsuyama on 17 and 18 when the stakes were the highest. And look at this. He joins this list of players who have won multiple times this season on the PGA Tour. Scottie Scheffler with six, and then you have five guys each with two wins. Rory McIlroy, Robert McIntyre, what a story he's been this year. Xander Schauffele, a two-time major champ, Nick Dunlap, who's in that lead right now, you would think, for PGA Tour Rookie of the Year honors, and Hideki Matsuyama. That's Matsuyama's third multi-win season in his career. So some notes for the BMW Championship. It's that 50-player field. 17 of the 28 players have won a PGA Tour event this season. The seven previous winners of this event, five past FedEx Cup champions, including Victor Hovland, Rory McIlroy, Patrick Cantlay, Justin Thomas and Billy Horschel, who won it 10 years ago. Now let's hear from number one and number two. This was back on Sunday as they looked ahead to this week's BMW Championship.
Plenty of positives. I'll just take the BMW next week. Of course, that I don't know if anyone in the field has played. What's your kind of like plans as you kind of move towards next week?
Well, we're going to head over there tonight. I heard we get golf carts tomorrow, so I'm going to enjoy that in the middle of the playoffs. That's going to be nice. So we're going to go play some golf tomorrow. I'll probably do a lot lighter day Tuesday, and then I think we have a prayer on Wednesday. So, typically Monday would be kind of my light off day. This week going forward with the carts on Monday, I'm going to, make that my full day of practice and then take a slow day on Monday or on Tuesday.
When was the last time you played golf at altitude?
I actually played golf at altitude this summer. We were in Colorado. It wasn't competitive golf, but I do remember a tournament on the Corn Ferry Tour we played at some pretty good elevation. We actually played two events. One, it was kind of near Denver. The other one was in Columbia. So played at elevation before, and it has its own challenges, but, I have kind of a system that I like to go to, and it's worked decent in the past, so hopefully it continues to work next week.
What's the biggest, takeaway you'll take to next week and things that maybe you might want to work on in the coming days?
Each event is sort of its own. I know we're sort of in this playoff run here, but to me, Memphis has gotten the best of me a lot of times. So I'm happy I was able to sort of overcome some demons here on this property and shoot a nice number here.
Actually, it's Indiana, Scott. Maybe I'm forgetting. When was the last time you played at altitude? Was it Chapultepec, maybe?
For the WGC in Mexico, I imagine. Yeah, that was 8,000 feet, I want to say. So it's going to be similar, I guess, with how hot it is, and about, just under 7,000 feet. I think, guys are going to have charts using their, machines to try and get a feel for, how far an 8-iron or, anything you hit really high goes.
So it's rare we see guys play at elevation, and it's going to be an interesting watch for the 50 guys in the field here in Colorado, more than a mile high at Castle Pines Golf Club. You got number one and number two, both playing well based on what they did last week, and Scottie Scheffler and Xander Schauffele. Who is your favorite after the first leg to go on to win the FedEx Cup playoffs?
It's kind of hard not to pick Scottie Scheffler, but we could say that any week of the year, whether we're in the regular tour season or in the FedEx Cup playoffs. A guy who's got six wins and a couple of second place finishes and never seems to finish outside of the top 10. Even Rory McIlroy said that heading into last week. You just don't expect Scottie to ever finish outside the top five. And to me, this brings me to, I suppose, my fundamental problem with the playoffs is that in most sports, it distinguishes what you do in the regular season. It might give you a mild advantage heading into the playoffs, but it's not really, the playoffs are not designed to tell you who was the best player all season. They're designed to tell you who's the best in the playoffs. And the PGA Tour historically has always put its thumb on the scale, trying to engineer an outcome in the playoffs because they want the best players, the biggest names to be there at Eastlake on Sunday. And they have succeeded in doing that. Whether or not it ought to be a reflection of the best player of the season, I'm not quite sure, but it's certainly been set up that way right down to the staggered scoring system. And mathematically, Xander's the only guy who could possibly pass Scottie Scheffler this week at the BMW Championship. There isn't a single person in golf who can afford to give Scottie Scheffler two shots on the first tee at Eastlake. I don't care who you are or what your record is on the course. And no one's got a better record really on that course than either Rory McIlroy, has won three times. Mm-hmm. Xander has won there, but he has twice in the staggered scoring system either had the best 72-hole score or the tied 72-hole score, but it wasn't enough to win because of the staggered scoring
but
system.
But it's funny, he would get the world ranking points.
He would.
For a win.
He gets a record in the OGW or WGR for the win.
It's like a ghost
victory. The trophy.
Yeah.
And certainly he's not getting the money for the win either. But those guys have a tremendous record in that golf course, and I'm not sure either one of them would fancy their chances if Scottie Scheffler starting two strokes ahead of them, at least.
And talking with guys last week, they were all saying what you said. They're like, you cannot spot Scottie any shots going into the Tour Championship. On my end, and I have a buddy who's a very casual golf fan, and I mean, he's one of those guys, he'll count every shot and shoot 124. And he'll watch a handful of times a year. So we had an ongoing joke pre-Masters, we would do picks. And he kept saying, I think Schauffler's going to win. And I, at the time, I think he realized Scottie Scheffler and Xander Schauffele were two different guys. He would just piece it together as one last name. We're like, all right, so just picking Schauffler.
A hell of a Ryder Cup pairing if it was one guy.
But if you just pick Schauffler every major, he would have gotten three or four right this year. So a little bit of a cop-out. But I think that it's going to be those two down the stretch trying to win it. For Xander, you would think he'd have the advantage at East Lake with what he's done historically, but it's a slightly different looking course with the renovation. Yeah. I think for Scottie Scheffler, he really wants to put the stamp down, where if he wins it and ends up with a 7 or 8 win season, a major, a Players, a gold medal, a FedEx Cup championship, then you're on the short list of greatest seasons we've seen in the last 25 years. So I think he has a lot of motivation, especially blowing a 6-shot lead 2 years ago in the Tour Championship, last year not playing well either. He's talked about trying to figure out ways to keep his energy up throughout the course of an entire season, something he hasn't been able to do the last couple years, where we saw world number one type Scottie Scheffler in the beginning of the year. We didn't see that at the end of the year. This year, it's just been consistent domination. I think he wants to take it to the finish line.
That's remarkable that he has kept the energy up, given that he's a new father as well and probably isn't sleeping that well. Well, that's what we're looking forward to next week. This week, for the BMW Championship out in Denver, what to you is the biggest storyline that's going to happen this week, or has the potential for the most engaging storyline?
And I know you have a good one, so that's, I'd say this is maybe secondary. It's just how starved the Colorado golf market is to see an event like this. It was 10 years ago they had the BMW Championship over at Cherry Hills. Castle Pines was one of my favorite courses to watch when it had the International from 1986 to 2006. The property's spectacular. They've done a massive renovation to the clubhouse and the golf course. So I think the fan support is going to be off the charts. And for viewers at home, getting to see the sights this week of Mountain Golf is going to be a really fun watch.
Especially if you've been sweltering in Memphis for the last week. It's probably going to be pretty good for the Players too. I'm fascinated by a Player Advisory Council meeting that's happening this afternoon, where they're going to be discussing, considering changes to the whole idea of eligibility on tour, the number of cards for players, perhaps the number of pathways being narrowed onto the PGA Tour, even field sizes being discussed. And that's a very fraught issue. There are a lot of stakeholders in that, not least the players, but tournament organisers, sponsors, broadcasters, all of whom have a product they're selling, and the nature of that product is going to get changed at some point, it seems. And a lot of the rank and file members of the PGA Tour are probably going to start to feel a little bit squeezed of what may come out of this meeting. So I think that's got the potential to turn into an interesting conversation this week.
Yeah, definitely a conversation that you're going to hear whispers from after the fact to have an understanding of where the tour could be kind of maybe shifted or changed for the future product going forward. Here are the FedEx Cup standings right now for the top 10. You got Scottie Scheffler, Xander Schauffele. Those are two different guys. Hideki Matsuyama, currently number 3. Sungjae Im, for the moment, would round out the top 10.
Well, our favorite wallflower is here right after the break. You ask Billy Horschel a question, you get a straight answer. He's in the mix at the FedEx Cup playoffs, and we're going to talk about the state of his game and the game. He's coming up next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Ah, man, Mountain Golf is hard to beat. The second leg of the FedEx Cup playoffs beginning this week in Colorado, as the top 50 in the FedEx Cup standings are teeing it up at the BMW Championship at Castle Pines Golf Club. First round coverage coming your way Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Golf Channel. Let's flash back a decade ago to another BMW Championship. Billy Horschel in full sprint to the finish line at Cherry Hills. Took home the title by 2 over Bubba Watson. It was his first win that season and 4th top 10. And, of course, it led to bigger and better things the very next week, Eamon.
Yeah, he didn't have to wait too long for another victory. At East Lake Golf Club, 7 days later, he grabbed the biggest win of his career in the Tour Championship, beating Jim Furyk by 3 shots to claim the FedEx Cup title. And that was despite starting the playoffs in 69th place in the standings. And a pretty impressive career Billy Horschel has built for himself, with a remarkable consistency here. He owns 8 PGA Tour victories, the most recent coming back in April at the Corrales Punta Cana Championship. 72% of career cuts made on the PGA Tour. 6 times he's made it all the way to East Lake, including 3 of the last 4 seasons. And Billy Horschel joins us now
from Denver, Colorado. Billy, thanks for the time. You were started last week in Memphis, 23rd in the FedEx Cup points. You moved up to 19th. Do you start to feel a little bit safer for your position at Eastlake at this point?
I do. I knew last week if I could have a good week. Obviously, finishing top 10 helps. The higher you finish, the more points you get. But having a good week was going to help this week be a little bit more secure, be a little safer. After talking with Tom, who's our FedEx guy, who was in the trailer on Sunday, he says I'm just short of being safe. But I feel pretty confident that I'm going to have a good week this week and get back to Eastlake, which I love so much.
Billy, how has the player perception of the FedEx Cup playoffs evolved over the last decade to what we currently see with top 50 getting in and then, or top 70 getting into the playoffs and top 50 being so meaningful as well?
I think everyone's got an opinion. We know that. We've got 200 plus members out here. Everyone's going to have their say in what they believe is the right system and what isn't the right system. But I think going to 70 is huge because I think you're rewarding guys to have a better year. You're making it a tighter space to get players into the top 50, into the Eastlake. And I think, listen, the final that we have at the Tour Championship there in Eastlake with the strokes, I know it's not the perfect system, but I think when you look at what we had in the past with the points and trying to figure out, you know, the point structure and Steve Sands being on there with his board and doing all the points, people were still, even with Steve Sands doing an unbelievable job, we were all still confused. So the system we have now may not be perfect, but I think it allows the viewers on at the Tour Championship to understand where everyone is standing in the FedEx Cup and what they need to do to win the FedEx Cup.
Do you think these weeks are difficult for players, even you, Billy, in terms of having a split focus? Because most weeks you go out there and the goal is simple, to try to win. For a lot of guys during the playoffs, it's a kind of a split goal. Yeah, you want to win, but you also trying to want to live to fight another week. And in your case now, you're safe for next week, but you're also trying to better position yourself to take advantage of that scoring system next week.
You're exactly right. I'm not going to lie to you. Sunday, I was super nervous. I was more nervous Sunday last week at FedEx than I was at the Open Championship trying to win a major. I just think when you're trying to, you know, get to the next spot, trying to improve, trying to get a secure into the Tour Championship, which means a lot to me. I don't know why I was more nervous last week. I should have been more nervous at the major, at the Royal Troon. But yeah, it's important. I mean, it's tough to really just get back to playing golf and trying to win a golf tournament and play the best you can and not worry about the strokes, where you fall in the FedEx Cup, how many points you need. So it's a live and learn, and even at being 15 years on tour, I'm still learning how to deal with it sometimes.
Billy, there are a number of guys who said the same thing, and I think for golf fans, it's cool to hear in a way because it shows you guys care and you want that stage to almost feel elevated these final three playoff events. We had a conversation earlier in the summer, and you've been on quite the run. The last 16 events, 11 top 25, 7 top 10s. You had that win in Corrales Punta Cana Championship. And you had said it was, I believe, the beginning of the Florida swing where it came together. Was it a eureka moment? Or what has clicked for you over these past several months?
I'm not sure if it was a eureka moment. I think it was just a buildup of everything we've been doing since the U.S. Open last year out in L.A., building, learning, you know, why we were struggling so much at the beginning of the first 6 months of the year, figured that out with the lie angles on the clubs, and then it was just really getting rid of all the bad golf shots that I had hit over 6 months that I have never seen in my life. And so Todd Anderson, my entire team, working hard, just day in, day, getting better. And I think at the Florida swing, I finally just really let go a little bit, finally realized I needed to stop trying to protect hitting a bad golf shot and trust that if I made the right swing, I was going to hit a really good golf shot, give myself the better chance of hitting a great golf shot. And I think from then on, I just carried that same mentality going forward. And I've seen a lot more quality golf shots. I've seen a lot, you know, more quality results, which obviously when you think about it, you're putting, you know, more confidence in the bank and you can, you know, you have something of recent memory to go back on, fall back on.
Speaking of putting something in the bank, Billy, you're the kind of guy who knows what it's like to go all the way at the FedEx Cup. Back in 2014, the top prize then was $10 million. Would you ever have imagined that that check would be $25 million now in this game?
No. Listen, $10 million at the time was a lot of money, and still $10 million at this time and day and age would be a lot of money. So I was very fortunate fortunate and very happy that I won the FedEx Cup and I got $10 million. And I could never imagine that 10 years later we'd be playing for $25 million for winning the FedEx Cup. So it's amazing to see, you know, the growth of the PGA Tour over the last decade. And listen, I understand, you know, there's been some division over the last 2 years, and it hasn't been a smooth sailing. But I will say we have a great group of players out here that support the PGA Tour. We have great sponsors. We have a PGA Tour that's working really hard trying to make our lives even better. Everyone in that building is trying to make us better players, you know, make us more financially rewarded. So, listen, it hasn't been easy the last couple of years, but the tour and everyone else has been together and trying to build this product into a better product, and I think we're getting there.
Billy, part of that playoff run 10 years ago included that win in the Mile High City, different venue over at Cherry Hills. Your early impressions of Castle Pines, and what are your keys to playing and thriving in mountain golf?
Well, I've heard for many years now that this may be the toughest walk in all of golf, and you know, that's saying something when you think about Kapalua or Augusta, or even Memorial, Moorfield, which is it's a challenging walk in itself. But I think this one's going to be one heck of a challenge this week. The course looks absolutely beautiful. I drove around it yesterday, hit some putts on some greens. Just a beautiful golf course. Playing at this altitude is really fun. You get to hit the ball really far. It makes me feel like I'm a long guy on tour, which I'm not by a long shot. But I think the thing is just getting comfortable with how far the ball goes. We're lucky enough now that we have TrackMan and Foresight GC Quad to be able to dial in the distances out here to tell us how far we're hitting each club, which makes it a lot easier. So I just think it's just getting comfortable with how far the ball goes and trusting what those numbers are, because, I mean, you may be hitting pitching wedges from 210 yards this week that you would never do anywhere else.
That's George's duck pitching wedge distance, Billy. There is a Players Advisory Council meeting this afternoon where the topic of eligibility is going to be discussed and potential changes to, say, the number of cards available to players on tour, maybe pathways being narrowed, field sizes being adjusted. Do you think that's going to be in any way a tough sell if changes were made on that to the rank-and-file members who might already start to feel a little bit squeezed, Billy?
I will say this. I've been an advocate for all 15 years of my PGA Tour of trying to make it a better product. I was on the PAC for 3 or 4 years. I haven't been on the PAC for 2 years. So my early days on the PAC, you know, when we talked about trying to make the PGA Tour a better product, one thing I thought about, and I've said it publicly, and I will stand on this, is that I think reducing cards on the PGA Tour is not a bad thing. You automatically increase the phone hung up. Oh, temperature. Sorry. You automatically, you know, make the product a better product with reducing cards, less players, less cards to go around. So I do believe that having maybe narrowing the, making the product a little bit smaller, not by a lot, maybe reducing it by 30, 40 cards goes a long way. So, you know, we'll see. I think guys are realizing that for the growth of the PGA Tour to continue to grow, we have to make changes. We can't stay status quo. We've got to make some hard changes for the next 25 years so that growth of the PGA Tour is still going forward and guys in the next couple generations are able to reap the financial rewards that we all have over the last several decades.
Billy, completely get the mentality of
the phone went hot.
Constantly changing and evolving as you're multitasking here.
Can't hear you. Your temperature.
Just lost Billy. Billy, best of luck this week. Fortunately, cut out right when it's getting juicy, because I'm curious when he says that reducing cards means the product will get better. Under what metric? And that's what I don't understand. And you hear a lot of high-profile guys who say, oh, we've got to reduce cards, we've got to reduce field sizes. Is that what fans want? And I haven't seen data to support that your average fan would rather watch 50 guys or 70 guys versus 144 or 156.
I think it's built on a sentiment that sport is built around your superstars, and you're trying to deliver a product that has more prominent names. But to me, it really cuts under the whole idea of sport, which is the David and Goliath, and this tilts perhaps a little bit more towards the Goliaths, and the Goliaths are making the decisions. And I suppose it's a valid question. Should players actually have a voice in making those decisions versus, say, the executives they put in charge of the tour? Because players, as we've seen over the last few years, they will always make decisions based upon where they are in their own careers. And we all make selfish decisions in life. Players are not going to be much different in that respect. But it's an issue for tournament organizers in terms of the field sizes, because, you know, if you have 70 guys versus 140, well, that's a lot of less window to sell concessions. Yep. and beer to fans. If you're a broadcaster, it's a lot less action to show. If you're a sponsor, it feels, in some ways, it can feel like a lesser event. It's a little bit quieter. That was very noticeable at Bay Hill this year. Normally one of the liveliest events on tour. And on Wednesday afternoon, on the range in the putting green, it was dead out there because the field had been reduced by half.
For the sponsors, some of the high-profile sponsors, it gives them security knowing that the stars will play 4 days, yeah, and that they can advertise that it's going to be 4 days of Rory McIlroy or Scottie Scheffler. When it comes to reducing cards, golf seems to be the only sport that is currently saying, let's remove jobs for guys on that stage, where every other sport has maintained the number of teams or is looking at expansion in the future. Yet golf is going to contract the number of players that play year in and year out on tour. That's the part that's hard for me to reconcile, because I just, aside from the rich wanting to get richer and having these star players not have to worry about cuts, I haven't seen any other supporting either data or thought process where it makes sense for the average fan to say, this is much better for my experience.
Yeah, and you can back players, and you usually hear it from elite players who will point out, you know, that mediocre golf pays very well out there, and perhaps there ought to be a higher bar set. That's fair enough, but there are a lot of guys out there and on the pathways to the PGA Tour, and those pathways have been long established. They've earned their card, and they're getting squeezed. They're not being given the opportunities that historically have come with that card. So you can make a valid argument on either side of it that it, in terms of the decision that's being made and possibly even who's actually making those decisions.
And the final thought, it is shifting towards what the PGA Tour was like in the 70s and early 80s, when only the top 60 were exempt. And when you first start, you'd have to make cuts to then make the next event. It was way more.
They create a Monday queue every week. Let's put 10 spaces in that.
It was way more cutthroat then, before they started doing this all-exempt tour where 125 became the number. Yeah. So it seems like their evolution is kind of skewing more towards their roots 50 years ago.
The goalposts are changing day by day, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, certainly are. So still ahead on golf today, Jon Rahm definitely shocked the golf world last year when he left the PGA Tour for LIV Golf. Is life all good for Rahm, or is there maybe some regret? Jaime Diaz joins us next with more details on the two-time major champion. Let's flash back to the 2021 U.S. Open at Torrey Pines. Jon Rahm, remember, this was his first big breakthrough in a major in dramatic fashion. Rahm closing with clutch birdies on 17 and 18. The final round to edge Louis Oosthuizen by a single stroke and get his first major victory at the U.S. Open. And a couple years later at the Masters, Rahm get a major victory number two, slipped on the green jacket at Augusta National as he beat Phil Mickelson and Brooks Koepka by four shots, becoming the fourth Spaniard to win the Masters.
Well, back in December, in a move that stunned quite a few people, Rahm decided to leave the PGA Tour to join LIV Golf. In a recent Golf Digest article, a veteran tour insider was quoted as saying the two-time major winner's having second thoughts about that move. But that was just one line in a much more expansive piece, and the author of that article is here now, our colleague Jaime Diaz joining us. Jaime, your thesis for this article had less to do with the idea of whether or not Jon Rahm is happy with the decision that he's made, but with the broader theme of whether or not players can be trusted to make decisions for the good of the game versus their own selfish interest. You didn't seem very optimistic in the story that is actually the case.
Well, I think it's an individual case. I mean, not everyone has jumped to LIV, but certainly the temptation of LIV is so great now. The money is so much exponentially greater than what used to be available outside of the tour or the PGA Tour that I think it's just created a different equation in players' minds. And sometimes now money has been chosen over sort of the traditional pursuit of self-improvement and greatness in the game for the most talented players, and just simply having the stability of the PGA Tour not be disrupted by people jumping away. I think that now is weighed against, generational wealth, multi-generational wealth, And some players, like John, decided to take the money. That has had all kinds of repercussions, of course. But I don't think the assumption that used to be perhaps when Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer, for example, could have jumped away and with Gary Player formed sort of a big three satellite that would have been its own mini tour in a way. They had a chance to make more money, but they didn't give it really serious consideration, probably because in part the money was not nearly as multiple as it is now. But also I think they felt an obligation to a tour that was still a fledgling tour and not to destroy it. And now I think players feel like the tour is autonomous enough with its own sort of infrastructure that it can handle people leaving. But I think there's a critical mass that at some point it could really not just disrupt the tour, but bring it down completely.
I mean, just curious, looking through a historical lens, when the PGA Tour split off from the PGA of America in 1968, were there financial motivations for Arnie and Jack to spearhead that?
I don't think so. No. Well, yes, in the sense that they thought it'd be a better product and it'd be better run. Their big argument was the PGA of America was not really the ideal sort of administrator for the PGA Tour, and it would be better with its own managers. And so it was a split basically to create a business that was going to be more efficient. The money was something that they thought would come along with that. But they were getting independent offers to split off and play, you know, exhibitions, play against, you know, what you saw on television, some of those matches, Big Three Golf, make that sort of a permanent part of their careers. And both Jack and Arnold, and I've never talked to Gary about it, but decided, no, that first of all, was not what they wanted because they wanted to make history, but also it was going to be bad for the tour, bad for the collective.
Jaime, you talked to some legends about whether or not being wealthy is conducive to seeking out excellence in this game, whether or not it's a motivator or an impediment for guys who are trying to get better. What was the reaction from guys? I mean, you talked to Faldo, you talked to Gary Player on that theme. What did you hear from them?
Well, in Gary's case, he said, you know, he needed money. He didn't grow up rich, but that having money as the sole motivator was not going to be a deep enough kind of passion to do the excellent kind of accomplishments over so many years that he achieved. Nick was interesting because he definitely wanted to make money at the beginning. That was sort of the motivator. I wanted the good car. I wanted to fly first class. I wanted to have a good home near Wentworth. But once he got those things, the innate sense of greatness, which or the desire to be great, which was in there as well, started to get a little bit diluted. It was harder for him to keep the same motivation. Now, he did great things even once he achieved that wealth, but it was harder to sustain it. And, you know, once he won at 96 at the Masters, that sort of fulfilled, I guess, the inner motivations he had for, you know, winning six majors and making history. And it was just harder at that point to bring up what he had when, you know, he was broke as far as the, you know, kind of the urgency to be a great player.
I mean, we've had a lot of talks in the newsroom, and I know you're a sports fan as well, beyond just a golf fan and a historian who's covered the game for a long time. I'm curious, when you look at other sports, like Patrick Mahomes, one of the highest paid players in the NFL, LeBron James, the NBA, Major League Baseball, Shohei Ohtani gets a massive contract. There's never a concern that with the money, there's going to be this dip in performance when guys are at the peak of their powers. Why is that the case for golf?
Well, first, George, you're talking about superstars there who I think are innately motivated to be great. And there are examples, certainly in the NFL. Oh, he got his big contract. He's not as good anymore. So there's some of that as well. But I think really in the team sports, the window is so small for the career. I mean, relatively speaking, you know, 5, 6 years, 7 years of prime peak performance with the exceptional guys like LeBron. It's a little longer. But in general, you got to make it while you can. In golf, the career is a lot longer. And so I think when a golfer does it, there's a sense that he sold out something that would have been a lucrative 15-year career, 20-year, 25-year career, and more if he wanted to play PGA Tour champions, for example. And so it seems more damaging to the collective at that point to see somebody jump, because that, you know, used to be kind of the dream is, you know, we have a great long career here. And we need to have unity among our players to keep it going as far as we are presenting the best golf in the world. And when people leave, that hurts the product. And so I think there's more of an objection to it from within on the golf tour than there would be, you know, as you know, there were old leagues, AFL, NFL. And when they merged, that ended up being a better product. But that merger was easier to do than this merger's happening, if it ever happens. So, you know, I just think golf's more problematic. And when a player leaves, there's bigger consequences.
And all those leagues, we've seen mergers, NBA, ABA in the 70s, AFL, NFL, like you mentioned, Major League Baseball, you had an AL and an NL in the early 1900s that merged together. So to your point, there has been a natural evolution for basically every major North American sports league in which there has been some type of merger.
There has. And I'm not saying it won't happen in golf, but look how difficult this one has been. Mm-hmm. And plus, it's not really apples to apples, you know, PGA Tour versus LIV. LIV plays a completely different product. It's got guaranteed money. Merging those, they're not, you know, AFL, NFL, that was the same game with pretty much the same, maybe not salary structure, but, you know, the same kind of careers as far as the players themselves. The merger was pretty much seamless. This one is not going to be seamless. Same with the ABA and NBA was fairly seamless, and it improved the product. This thing is like, what are the actual parameters going to be if they ever happen? And will the nature of competitive golf change in a way that perhaps will dilute the product? So I think the issues are much more problematic and much more complicated.
On this idea, Jaime, of golfers having long careers, long lucrative careers, you talked to former PGA Tour commissioner Dean Beaman, who seemed to suggest to you in this Golf Digest article that you're going to see players with a lot shorter careers. And as a result of that, it's going to be harder for superstars to emerge.
Yeah, Dean had a very interesting equation. First, it starts with the nature of the game now, in his opinion anyway. The emphasis on speed has made the younger player more prominent earlier in his career. He also sort of feels the game is somewhat simpler to play now because of equipment advances and because distance is so important, that all the nuances that you kind of learn over time aren't quite as important. But the other thing is just simply, you know, so as a result, players, when they start to lose speed, let's say in their early 30s, they become relatively less competitive than they would be now. And so they will age out faster. That's the theory. And then the other thing, of course, is just the money. The money, it will be greater. The motivation to continue to play will be lessened. The careers will be shorter. The career records won't be as grand, and the traditional measures of greatness won't be measured up to as often. That's his theory. I thought it was interesting. I thought it makes a lot of sense as well.
I mean, there are two compelling narratives with Jon Rahm. If you look at what he's done in 2024, the major season, a bit of a disappointment, slow start until the Open. He had a top 10 finish. If you look at LIV, he's finished top 10 every start, has had five top threes, just got his first win. He's the leading in points for an individual right now on the LIV Golf Tour. He's at the top of the mountain. You had the quote, obviously, saying that there could be some regret with Jon Rahm. Where do you think he is at this point of the year with his decision?
Well, it's so hard to say. It's just a matter of opinion. Again, informed opinion that the source in my story, and it wasn't an isolated one, he expressed. I think with John has always been known as a passionate player who was very aware of history and wanted to be great and wanted to beat the best players. And he still thrives on that. As we saw at the Olympics, how disappointed he was. That was a great stage for him. He looked like he was re-energized to a large extent. He's played okay on LIV. He's won once. He's always top 10. I don't think top 10 on LIV is considered a great measure of you know, somebody's great performance at this moment. I think John's still capable, obviously, of being a great player, but he doesn't have the platform and he doesn't have the sort of palette to kind of paint his ideal picture right now. And so I think it's speculative, but it's especially considering his earlier comments, you know, that, gee, I wish I could still defend my titles from last year early in the season. He said that. He said he wished LIV would go to 72 holes. I think it's fair to expect, and he also said, you know, I think I could be a tipping point perhaps to a merger, that he was hoping for a merger. And now as it's not happening, at least with the, short time frame that it was sort of projected to, it's reasonable to think that, you know, he's sorry that's not happening. I have no evidence firsthand at all that, you know, he wants to go back, anything like that. Even the quote from the source was a hypothetical that if he could give the money back, I think he would. We don't really know. But given the anecdotal evidence of his earlier comments and the kind of player we know John to be and his reaction at the Olympics, I just think it's natural to wonder if he could do it over again, would he?
Do you think it's fair to say, Jaime, that going to LIV has worked in different ways for different players? Obviously, the jury's still out in terms of John Rahm. It's certainly way too early to suggest, as some people out there are, that it's diminished him as some kind of competitive force, which I don't think is true yet. But you take guys like Kepka and DeChambeau, you could argue that it has had no real detrimental impact on them, particularly on Bryson. It might actually have elevated Bryson in some ways. But is a fundamental issue here, these are all guys who still point to major championships as the metric by which they want to be measured for their career. And the one thing that LIV does is take away their ability to prepare for those major championships in the manner which they might ideally want. Now, some guys may want to go play Valderrama the week before the Open Championship. Other guys might actually have liked being on a links course, or some guys do want to play in Orlando the week before the Masters. Is that really an issue that sort of underplayed the idea of that they're kind of hostage to the LIV schedule and not able to prepare for the tournaments that then measure their legacy?
Well, I think it's individual to the player according to how they like to prepare. I think someone like Bryson, who's such a unique kind of approach to the, has such a unique approach to the game. So much of it's on the launch monitor. He doesn't really play that much golf, but he's very obsessed with getting better. The extra time he gets by being a LIV player, as opposed to the obligations to play a lot, probably help him. I think Brooks has always been so focused on majors that he's always going to get up for majors. But having said that, I think there's an argument that he may not be quite as competitively sharp, even though he never seemed to put a lot of priority on regular events on the PGA Tour. You're still in that milieu where you're around guys who are better than you or playing better than you, and you've got to, you know, you've got to dig deep and keep getting better. I think on LIV, it's easier to coast. He seems happy to coast, that he did win that PGA, but he hasn't played particularly well since then. I think you look at Cameron Smith and DJ and Patrick Reed, and their performance has fallen way off. What do you attribute it to? I don't think they've lost their ability either, but they may have lost their motivation. I just think guaranteed money in golf is a softener, unless you're someone who's just so innately motivated that it doesn't matter. And I think, I don't even know if that person exists. You know, and having talked to those other players, Pete Cowan, for example, who's worked with so many, he goes, once the money really starts flowing, it's harder to get a player to commit, to focus with the same intensity and the same passion that he did when he was hungry. Staying hungry is the challenge, and I think LIV makes it harder to stay hungry.
That I understand. I would push back. I mean, Brooks Koepka won a major last year. Bryson DeChambeau won a major this year. If the season ended right
George,
now.
George, I wasn't arguing against Bryson.
But if the season ended right now, John Rahm would be LIV Golf Player of the Year. So I get the emphasis on the number of victories, and that's how we measure the greats. But he's the leading point getter. So for his performance through LIV, he's been the best of anyone on that tour this season.
Well, it's all relative to how highly you rate LIV. I don't consider their golf as challenging as the PGA Tour. And I'm probably getting in trouble for this, saying this. I'd like to see a Korn Ferry All-Star game against a LIV All-Star game or, you know, 20 guys deep. And, you know, I wonder how that would go, but who knows, you know, but I just don't think that LIV just presents the same standard week to week. And if you want to extrapolate from that, it probably would mean that there's an edge that PGA Tour players have that LIV players don't. I know. Brooks won that major, but Brooks didn't always exhibit that edge on the PGA Tour. Admittedly, majors have made, you know, his career. He's incredible, and he's a historical player as a result. But is he arguably as prepared as he used to be for majors? Looking at his record, it's such a small sample, but I think there's an argument that he's not.
Always a provocative conversation with Jaime Diaz. Jaime, thanks for the time today.
Thanks, Eamon. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Jaime.
Well, let's keep the Spanish theme rolling here. Then we go from the overpaid to the unpaid. Jose Luis Ballester became the first Spaniard to win the US Amateur on Sunday at Hayes O'Teen Golf Club. He joins us right after this break.
Think back in time. How well do you remember your 21st birthday? Often a question the day after. Well, on Sunday, Jose Luis Ballester became the first player from Spain to win the U.S. Amateur, holding off Iowa sophomore Noah Kent to win two up on his 21st birthday with the win. You love that. He joined John Rahm as the only other Spaniard to win a USGA event. So here's what the winner receives. It's part of the 124th U.S. Amateur gold medal. Custody of the Habermeyer Trophy for 1 year, exemption from qualifying for the next 10, assuming obviously you stay in AM and you get spot next year in the U.S. Open, as well as the Open at Royal Portrush and a likely invite to the 2025 Masters. So now let's welcome in Arizona State rising senior Jose Luis Ballester. Goes by Jose Le, and a heck of a way to celebrate your 21st with the Habermeyer Trophy. You've had a couple days now to reflect. What's it been like?
Well, I still think that it hasn't soaked in yet. I'm still in that process of realizing what it comes with winning the U.S. Amateur. But it's really cool to just be back here at ASU and celebrate with my people.
I read, Jose, that you were asked if this was going to make you the big man on campus at ASU, but you pointed out that you've got some pretty stiff competition for that title right now.
I can not compete against the main guy on campus right now. I think you all know who he is. His name is Leon Marchand. He just won 4 gold medals and 1 bronze at this past Olympics. So I might be quite famous right now, but he's the man.
You become the second Spaniard to win a USGA event following John Rahm, who of course won the US Open a few years ago. John Rahm was a standout during his time with the Sun Devils in Tempe. To follow in his footsteps and then join him in USGA history, how meaningful is that?
Super special. Not only being another Spaniard that has won a USGA championship, but being the first to win the US Amateur, it's even cooler, especially with all the great players that Spain has produced and all the great legends we had. To add my name into history in that way, in my 21st birthday, it's just a dream come true.
Did you have expectations entering the week, Jose Le, that you could actually walk away with the trophy at the end, or did you have to wait to a certain point in the week where you thought, you know what, I've got this, I can do this?
Yeah, it's different when you play these kind of events, right? When you play stroke play for 2 days and then you advance to match play. You obviously had high expectations for this, but I don't know if somebody that plays the band, knowing how it is to advance to the next round, thinks about winning as soon as the week starts. So I always kind of divide these tournaments in two tournaments. As soon as I made it to match play, then I tried to stay one match at a time, and that's what I did. And when I made it to the final, I'm like, well, I'm actually competing for the championship. So that was pretty cool to see.
We don't see many 36-hole championships, and that used to be integral to the game of golf on the amateur and the professional level over the last 100 years. This is one of the few that still remains. You were 4 up with, I believe, 7 or 8 holes to go, and it get pushed all the way to the 36. What was that mental test like?
Well, it's never easy to win. And it happened to me a couple times throughout the week in some of my matches. I was also 4 up with 6 to go in my first match against Ben James, and I ended up winning on 17 in a kind of dramatic way. But yeah, it's something weird happened to me on hole 13. Kind of like I lost track of my eyes with the ball, and I hit a really bad shot, something that has never happened before. And that was almost like a wake-up call saying, okay, I might be 4 out with 6 to go, but the job is not done. I still need to hit good shots if I want to finish this. And then he started playing good as well, grabbing that momentum. And you know how match play is. Momentum is everything. So it was good to hit some good shots coming down the stretch and making some good putts, because, it's never easy to close out a match.
Sergio Garcia has been something of a mentor to you over the years, and obviously you look up to Jon Rahm as well. At any point, did you let it pop into your mind that you could earn yourself a spot at the Masters next April, maybe play a practice round with those guys, with Jose Maria Olazabal as the fourth?
I haven't thought about it that much, honestly, because the match that gave me that exemption for the Master was when I won the semifinals, right? So I was really happy that I won that match and I made it to the championship final. But again, I was kind of sad because I just beat one of my best friends from the Spanish team. So I wish I had the chance to share that big moment with him in the final, but I couldn't. But yeah, now thinking about it, maybe having the chance to play a practice round with all those great players and master champions from Spain will be amazing.
Ozalea, you basically won an amateur major going into now your senior year at Arizona State. How does this change your goals or even your perception of your game going into the year?
Well, it just helps as a confidence booster. I still haven't won an individual title here at ASU, so that's my mainly goal for this final season. It was kind of funny, but during the ceremony at Hazeltine, coach said, well, are you ever going to win an event while you're in season? Because apparently I only win in the summer. So that was quite funny. So that would be something that I would love to accomplish before leaving ASU.
When you've achieved the pinnacle of amateur golf in the United States by winning this championship, does that make you at all think about taking the next step and turning professional any sooner than you might have if you didn't win it?
I don't think so. I still have 1 year left here at ASU, and I'm pretty excited to compete with the team. And again, it's so hard to win a tournament like the U.S. Amateur, but at the same time, you don't really need to be the best to win the event. You just got to make it to match play, and once you're there, you just got to beat the opponent you have in front. So again, I consider I'm a great player, but I still need this year to get fully ready for professional life.
Ozalea, I know you had dreams of being able to maybe indulge out of the Havermeyer Trophy, and you were telling us that the top doesn't come off, so you're going to have to find other ways to continue your celebration on your U.S. amateur victory.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Good to be...
No, go ahead, guys.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just going to say, yeah, good to be with you. Enjoy the time with your teammates before the start of your senior season, and best of luck.
Thank you. I will.
So as we go to break, another look at the U.S. amateur champion holding the trophy. More to come on the show as Golf Today continues on the other side of the short break.
Let's flash back to 2007. 25-year-old Irena Ochoa won her first major title, the AIG Women's Open at St. Andrews. It was the first time the Women's Open was contested at the Old Course. Just 6 years later, came back. Stacey Lewis secured her second career major title in St. Andrews. And now it's time for number three. The Women's Open returns to the Old Course this week. It's the final major in golf for 2024. You can catch live first-round coverage this Thursday at 7 a.m. Eastern Time, right here on USA Networks. And here is how the season has played out for the women's major, with Nelly Korda, Yuka Saso, Amy Yang and Ayaka Furuwa have launched the first four. That just leaves one spot left to be filled. And we're joined now by someone who has covered every Women's Open held at the Old Course in St. Andrews, Beth Ann Nichols from Golf Week. Beth Ann, I want to go back to that 2013 Open, crowning moment for Stacey Lewis. She's now back there as the Solheim Cup captain, kind of coming full circle with her career. And there's a rumour going around that she might actually be back in her old digs at the Dunvegan, where she held that famous party after her victory.
Absolutely. She followed in the footsteps of Lorena Ochoa, who stayed there as well and then had an epic party where basically anyone and everyone could come in and celebrate with Lorena. You know, when Stacey won here in 2013, the celebration was back in the back room with the rest of the Solheim Cup team, because she'd made the Solheim Cup team as well. And of course, this year it's a little bit different with her wearing that captain's hat, and she'll have the double duty of playing, but then also paying attention to what's going on with the American players as the last, you know, this is the last few rounds to make your final impression for Captain Lewis. But it's a really special place. This is her favorite place to play golf. All of her family, they're trying to recreate that magic from 2013. And that 5-iron that she hit in the road hole in 17 is still in her office in her Solheim Cup captain's bag. And it's the best shot of her career.
And such an incredible finish that she had down the stretch to get that major victory that week. How meaningful is it to have the AIG Women's Open at St. Andrews once again?
Well, there are so many players here for the first time, and they're of course posing for their pictures all around, you know, 17 and 18. And I said, it's funny. I saw, you know, Minji Lee and Hannah Green and Ann Van Dam. I think they staged like probably 6 pictures on one of the holes in the back nine, trying to get it just right, because it's just such an exciting time for all of these players. And you can see how important it is when you have Kari Webb coming back. She didn't think she would have another chance to play here at the Old Course, but realized in January that this might not ever come around again. And she wanted to have a third time here. And it's just such a special place for her. She says she still hasn't figured out the keys to getting around here, but whether you're on the beginning of your LPGA career, you're winding down, it's a special memory for sure.
On the subject of Kari Webb, Bethan, this became an official LPGA Tour major in 2001. Is there a case to make it retroactive to when it first began back in the 70s or some point in between, in which case Kari Webb would actually have a couple more major championships and as a Women's British Open winner, and perhaps even Laura Davies would be in the LPGA Hall of Fame?
It's certainly something that I've considered, especially when we look back at those past champions at the Chevron, you know, the early Dinah Shore days, that list. But you have to remember that the field was a lot different in those early days. Not a lot of LPGA players, American golfers, were coming over to compete in the early, you know, Weetabix British Open. So, you know, the field has gotten so much deeper. It's just a completely different event. Of course, you throw in the fact that it's now a major, and just when you add, you know, that one word to the tournament, the pressure, everything changes immensely. So while I do think that, you know, it's an interesting exercise and certainly would add a lot of majors for a lot of players and get Laura into the hall, I just don't think that when you compare, it's not an apples to apples thing just with what the field looked like back then.
Sticking with Laura Davies and what a career it's been for her. This was supposed to be her final LPGA start, but isn't going to end up giving it a go. Kind of your thoughts on how things are coming to an end for her with such a decorated career?
Well, I was absolutely gutted when I found out that she wasn't going to play. As you said, this was supposed to be the time that we all got to celebrate her and have that iconic, you know, photograph on the first and on the bridge on 18. And of course, she would have hit the first tee shot here. But, you know, Laura told me she got to the senior championship, the senior LPGA championship, and she stood over the first tee shot. And even though the tee shot wasn't that bad, the sheer terror that she felt before she hit it, she made the decision right then on that tee box that she wasn't going to play in this event. And you know, she said, I wish that I could come and not care how I played and just come enjoy the moment. You know, we know that Laura, you know, can be shy and she's not really big on being celebrated. But I do think that if her game was in a better place and she felt more confident, that she would have teed it up. But she just didn't want to come out here and have an embarrassing time. And she didn't want to have that hanging over her for months coming into the championship, that dread that we can all, she said, you know, I know a lot of people probably can't understand what it's like to go from being so in control of your golf game to being so terrified. I think we can all understand the terrified part, but you know, it really is a shame because I thought we'd have that moment, but of course she will be commentating on the event.
I can feel your terror, Laura, even on those first and 18th tee shots at the Old Course. End of an era there. 44 years she's had this streak going in the senior Women's British Open, Bethan. Nelly Korda, not at 44 years yet. She didn't play last week, the Scottish Women's Open. Is there value to having that rep on Lynx Golf before you show up at the Open Championship? Because a lot of the top players in the world did play last week. Is Nelly in any way, you think, disadvantaged heading into this week?
You know, I think it comes down to a personal decision and how you feel what you feel you need the most. And for Nelly, she probably needed rest and to regroup after the Olympics, which of course takes a lot out of you. You know, obviously she had a chance to medal again and didn't. And so I'm sure she did feel like she needed to spend some time to get everything back in order so that she felt like she was ready. You know, rest has been so important to her and spending time with her coach and in her bubble. And so maybe that was more important to her than having a few more, you know, reps of links golf.
But then Lauren Coughlin has what everyone else wants, and that's coming off a victory heading into this week, AIG Women's Open. When we always use the trope that once someone wins, they can rip off a number of wins in a short amount of time. She's actually done that now with her first two LPGA Tour victories over the last 2 months. What do you think of the career year she's had to this point as she's heading now to another major stage?
It's an absolutely dream year for Lauren. And I think what I love the most about Lauren's story is how she's continued to develop and continue to get better as an LPGA player. She was a walk-on at Virginia. Her coach went out and watched her at the state high school championship, which not a lot of coaches at that level spend a lot of time at state tournaments. But Lauren was just an athlete who loved golf, played other sports. And Kim Llewellyn saw that. And, you know, I think that athletic mindset is really, you know, taken her a long way. The love of the game, not having it be the sole thing that, you know, she did growing up, you know, has enabled her to stay fresh and to have that curiosity and that want to learn. And so she's learned how to play in the wind. She's learned how to play off uneven lies. These are things that she's just learning in recent years. And so, you know, she's going to have the time of her life at the Solheim Cup where it will be as close as it can be to a home Solheim Cup for her here coming up in a few weeks. And you know, just watching this tremendous ball striker really come a long way in terms of course management has really been what's been able to elevate her to this next level, coupled with great putting.
We've seen some great icons in this game say goodbye and pause on the Swilken Bridge on the 18th hole there in the Old Course. Beth Ann, are you expecting Lexi Thompson to make a similar gesture at some point this week?
You know, that'll be interesting. I think we'll all be looking for it. It's I'm not really sure what to expect out of Lexi next year, to be honest with you. I don't know, because she's kind of left that door open that she still might play in some events, that she's just retiring from full-time competition. What does that mean exactly? So I think we're not really sure how to answer that. So it's kind of this, uncertainty. So, you know, I think it'll be maybe a celebration with an asterisk. I'm not really sure.
Well, Beth Ann, I think this is one of the weeks where Eamon and I wish we were trading places. So enjoy your time in Scotland at the Old Course covering this week's AIG Women's Open.
Thank you so much.
So, Eamon, we'll have to settle for next best, and that's just waking up each and every morning and watching coverage from the Old Course. AIG Women's Open from St. Andrews begins Thursday, round one, 7 a.m. Eastern on USA. Then over the weekend, it starts on USA and will end over on NBC and Peacock. We'll be right back.
We're back on golf today. The PGA Tour moves from Memphis to Colorado this week for the second leg of the FedEx Cup playoffs. You can catch live first-round coverage of the BMW Championship this Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Golf Channel. Well, country music singer and songwriter Luke Bryan is, just like the rest of us, a demented golfer. He's also a member at Castle Pines Golf Club, this week's host site for the BMW Championship. He's got a concert date tonight. He's also got a pro-am tee time tomorrow. So let's find out if he's got any performance anxiety. Luke Bryan is joining us from where you find every great country singer. He's out there on the road. Luke, you're playing a concert tonight at the golf club. You've got the tee time tomorrow. Which one are you more nervous about, walking onto that stage or walking onto that first tee?
Definitely on the first tee. It's my second pro-am. I've learned the anxieties of the first tee with a bunch of people watching you. And, you know, the main thing is hopefully you don't take anybody out the tee box and land it somewhere out there and not take out any of the the patrons.
Well, that's what fans and pro-ams don't realize. They're used to the pros just piping it down there. When you got the ams in the mix, you don't want to get too close to those fairways.
Yeah, you better have your head on a swivel if you're watching my golf game.
Wait, so you're known as a Nashville guy. I mean, you've been there since the kickoff to your country career. What's the tie then to Castle Pines?
Got to meet the president of the of Castle Pines a couple years ago, George Solich, and developed a great golfing relationship with him. And he obviously, through our relationships, learned about how much I'd been playing golf and how much I had been teaching my boys. And George and Peyton Manning are friends, and Peyton's a member out here. So somehow somehow they decided to bring, let old country boy in the clubhouse out here. But it's just a beautiful track, beautiful, one of the prettiest courses, certainly in North America, with the Rocky Mountains in the background and the elevations and the different distances of the ball flights out here in the elevations. It's just an amazing course, and I can't wait to see these pros tackle it. It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun to be on stage tonight.
Luke, we've had a lot of musicians on this show over the years, and you see a lot of musicians get into golf, everyone from Willie Nelson to Niall Horan to Nick Jonas. What is it about you guys that always end up coming back to this sport?
Well, I think golf is just an escape from certainly the pressures of being in the music business, and to be able to go out there and spend some time in nature and then go with, like, you know, my biggest pleasure in golf right now is being able to take my three boys, my nephew Teal, he's 22 and he's starting to play pretty good golf, and my 16-year-old Bo is really good, and then my 14-year-old Tate is trending better than all of us. So to be able to go on little golf trips when I'm off the road and take the boys on these day trips, or go hop on the tour bus, go play a couple great courses and bond with them. And I, like I said, I think golf is just a great it's a great outlet for people in the music business, and it's something that you can, once you really get your golf game where you want it to be, you can carry it, you know, throughout the rest of your life and really have great memories and great experiences.
Luke, if it was this time last month, we'd be saying happy belated birthday. It was on July 17th. You're such a golf junkie. Your birthday cake had a golf theme to it from your wife, Caroline. We got to pop that up, get the viewers in on it, and then have your reaction to the cake that your wife had. The older I get, the harder it's to find my balls.
Yep, I mean, you know the deal. That's I run through a sleeve of them every round, and out here at Castle Pines was no different. I think.
You gotta love technology, right?
Yeah,
right when we get to the punchline there. Luke was on the side of the road. We got Luke back. So, Luke, you're surprised seeing that birthday cake from your wife, Caroline.
Yeah, well, it was a surprise seeing it on my actual birthday. And, yeah, you know, between fishing and hunting and golf, my wife's got plenty of ways to come up with creative birthday cakes, no doubt.
You spend a lot of time touring. Luke, do the clubs go with you on the road?
They do, and through the years, we've developed great relationships with some of the best golf clubs in the world. I've gotten to play Marion quite a bit, gotten to play Pine Valley and Augusta. And, you know, anytime I'm traveling, you know, people will, it's really, really, I feel really blessed and fortunate that some of these members extend an invite to some of these world-class courses through the years. And, you know, I've been a little under the weather with allergies and stuff like that. So sometimes I have to be a little careful about getting outside and playing too much golf when they're cutting grass. But if the allergies are feeling good and I can go out and play 9 or 18 the day of the show, I've been doing a lot more of that. And when the boys come out on the road, they bring their golf clubs, and we try to turn it into a golfing slash getaway where I do some concerts. So we've been incorporating a lot of golf into the tour the past couple of years.
You love to hear that. And golf venues matter, where guys won majors matters to them. If you're just a recreational golfer, where you get to play, maybe on the top 100 list, is the first thing you tell your buddies. With musicians, when I've talked with friends who travel, they say venues matter also when it comes to playing Red Rocks or other spots that could be kind of a spiritual meeting in a different way. 5 days from now, you're going to Wrigley Field. I'm a Chicago guy, grew up a diehard Cubs fan. It's rare that we see concert dates at Wrigley over the course of the summer when the Cubs are on the road. Where does that venue stack up among your favorites?
Well, just the history of Wrigley and the location of downtown, you know, the heart of Chicago, and me being a kid from South Georgia, watching the Cubs. I mean, obviously, I'm a big Braves fan. I played Truist Park last weekend, and being a Braves fan, but then everybody was kind of a Cubs fan also growing up. So growing up watching the Cubs at Wrigley to now knowing that I have a big concert there is just very, very surreal, and just yet another pinch-me moment, kind of like being a member of Castle Pines. You never can imagine you're going to get these opportunities in your life, and it's just been a great ride being in music, and then now as I get my music career going, it's nice to be able to get out here and play these pro-ams and hopefully be good enough to not embarrass myself too bad.
Well, you have a concert tonight over at Castle Pines. Are there any surprise guests? I mean, we saw Rory McIlroy carry a tune when he was celebrating winning the Zurich Classic. Maybe a duet?
You know, I'll have to get up with Rory, or, you know, I spend a lot of time with Justin Thomas. We play a lot of golf south of Nashville at Troubadour, and I'll have to see if JT's got the courage to get on stage tonight, render a tune, and I'm excited to when Xander Schauffele won the PGA at Valhalla. I was able to get in Valhalla a few years ago, so I was able to gift Xander a cigar from one of my private collections. So hopefully, I can see Xander.
We know Xander Schauffele, no stranger to a good stogie when he's celebrating from the Ryder Cup or after major victory. Number one, Luke Bryan on tour. That's all leading up to the September album release. It's Love You, Miss You. And
are you citing the album, or are you actually saying this to me too, George? I feel like we're sharing a tender moment here.
I was hoping you'd pick up the rest of the album there with its
release.
Love
You, Miss You, Mean It.
There we go, Eamon. I just wanted you to say something so thoughtful on the show here on Golf Today. Luke Bryan, one of the best, a man who has become really close to golf circles, professional golfers, like we said, a member this week at Castle Pines, who will be performing tonight and playing in the Pro-Am tomorrow. So good to be with him on Golf Today.